This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, today I welcome your telephone calls for writer Susan Neville. In her new book, she takes readers on a voyage into factories across the state of Indiana. All kinds of things are made in these factories: dolls, steel, globes, pills, cookies, and caskets. Neville's essays on how things are made can be found in her book, Fabrication, Essays on Making Things and Making Meaning. The book is published by McMurray and Beck. Susan Neville has been awarded the Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction for her book, The Invention of Flight. Her books also include In the House of Blue Lights, a Chicago Tribune notable book of 1998. She is on the faculties of Butler University and Warren Wilson College. She lives in Indianapolis, and she joins us this afternoon from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis. Listeners, if you would like to join us with questions or comments, here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Neville, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
To begin, I would like you to read right here at the top the first essay, How the Universe is Made. I think it's a great introduction.
Thank you. My next-door neighbor owns 7 white dogs. They're all outside this morning, all quiet, all running gracefully through the grass like the ghosts of deer. The dogs are small, rare, well-behaved, and odd-looking breeds. The 2 largest dogs are whippets, English greyhounds, spooky and muscular. They fly back and forth across the 6-foot fence between our houses, and it's utterly soundless, just a smudge of white one way and then the other. Their job is to be mysterious, weird, earthbound, angelic birds in the form of dogs. Sometimes they seem like that, and sometimes they seem too thin and crouching, sneaky and rabid, all toothy smile. Every day begins like this for a writer, with the vain attempt to try to get to, in words, something that's just beyond where words stop. This is your job, to throw the rope of words out and try to catch it, then to walk across the rope until the air gets tired of pretending to hold you up and the imaginary rope dissolves and you're plunged into a canyon. Though sometimes you take a leap across the canyon without a rope at all, a blind leap that doesn't involve faith, just the hope that there will in fact be a way to return to where you started. Either way, you often fall. Then you climb back up the rock face, skin your knees and hands, and throw the rope again. This is your trade, your work, what you do every day of your life. And so, I still don't have those whippets right, how dreamlike strange they are to me. I could throw words at them for the rest of my life and not quite get at the mystery. I wish that I could be a whippet, an earthbound mammal that gives the illusion of flight. Why do the dogs fly over the fence and back? Maybe they sense something in the air and think they can catch it in their teeth. What I love in this world is both the whippet and the rope of words. My neighbors have giant gumball machines and neon-striped jukeboxes and antique rose-colored lamps and antique sinks and a stained glass fox in the kitchen window and glass green walls. 2 weeks ago, they built a playhouse by the drainage creek. There are green lawn chairs for the children on the playhouse porch. The chairs are an intense green, not an indigenous color. My neighbors create their home at every moment, which involves both making things and tearing things down. Last week, the husband was up in a sweet gum tree with a chainsaw, balancing on a heavy branch and sawing off the limbs at the tip. Whack, thud, the screech of the chainsaw coming so close to his own powerful leg and his 3 children squealing and the 7 white dogs and the wind and the pile of leaves and bark, whack, thud, and a gathering of boys around the basketball hoop to play and to watch and the sun setting all orange and green and shining on the chainsaw's metal teeth. And when he got the thing delimbed, it was right through the trunk until the whole tree fell, and then 2 seconds through the trunk of a dogwood, and it was down too, and my neighbor standing there like Paul Bunyan, getting all the kids to carry limbs taller than they were out to the street to be carted away with the next day's trash. and within 2 minutes, he and his wife decided not to have the stump ground all to hell as they had originally planned to do, and instead to build an octagonal bench around it and scoop out the center to grow geraniums. The whippet's job is to jump. My neighbor's job is to build a life interesting enough to hold 7 dogs, 2 cats, and 3 children. And my job is to make things up, which has nothing to do often with inventing something new. I just sit here patiently picking up each object on the assembly line of perceptions, and then picking up the word that goes with that perception and placing it back down on the belt. Whippet. Wind. Paint green chair on the playhouse porch, that kind of satiny sheen that candy takes on when it cools. Pick up the image, package it in words, inspect the sounds, pass it down the line, next sentence, next image. Whippet. Wind, ghost, sweet gum tree. The light hits the top branch of the white pine, the metal porch on the bird feeder, the intricate mesh of the porch screen, one white rock. One red-haired neighbor checks the chlorine level in her children's above-ground pool. 2 fat red cardinals pick up sunflower kernels and fly to a branch of the black walnut tree. Those are the things I can see. There are other things I take on faith. At every moment, neutrinos pass back and forth through all these things that seem so solid and impenetrable, the bodies of the walnut tree, the cardinals, these fingers, as though we're not even here. The neutrinos are invisible, but apparently have mass. Where are they going? Flying through our bodies and the bodies of whippets and chainsaws and boys playing basketball and the insubstantial wind like that. This is the neutrinos' work. Pick up the image, wrap it up, lay it back down. Pick up another, do the same, lay it down. Now and then there's one that feels like a canyon's edge, a simple image on an assembly line that opens somehow magically into a vast landscape, and I leap off of or toward it. The difference between a detail and a metaphor, transubstantiation. You begin with one and end up with both. Sometimes the wine stays wine, sometimes it's both wine and spirit. You always start with wine, the first miracle. So drink this down. Inside the white dogs and my neighbor's bodies and my body and your own, there are, in addition to neutrinos, viruses. The virus's work, it seems, is to get its DNA into the host cell's RNA. According to a new study at Purdue University, the virus does this in the same way you insert a part into a car, by creating its own simple machine. Think about it. The virus makes an octagonal hole in the RNA and shapes the DNA into the same octagon, and the whole thing works like a bolt in a pair of human pliers, and it looks exactly like the bench my neighbors want to build around the sweet gum stump. To say that the universe tends toward disorder seems counterintuitive. Things seem instead to tend through labor toward further complexity and to follow some sense of aesthetics and shape, some pattern, and it's all more mysterious and awful and lovely than we can even begin to fathom. In January, scientists announced they had discovered eternity. The universe doesn't have an end, a canyon drop. It keeps expanding. It's at the edge that the universe makes itself up as it goes along. It's here in the center, or the edge of center, or wherever it is we are that we do the same. So that every cell, every massive and invisible neutrino, every virus, every particle and wave, every boy playing basketball, every neighbor building a playhouse, every whippet flying over a fence, every single living thing that does its work each day helps to make the universe.
Susan Neville, How the Universe is Made, the opening essay in her book, Fabrication. Have these essays made you more aware of your craft, of how writing is made?
Very much so, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I mean, I started with the word fabrication and loved that it means to make as well as to make up, and that it means to make things and also to, you know, fabricate meaning. So I guess I appreciate my work as work, and how similar it is to all work. I mean, it made me appreciate that.
Yeah. As you mentioned, it's a very interesting word, fabrication, because it can mean making something solid, or it can be, we can associate it with making something up.
Right.
And I think that's really, that's where the word resonates with me most, I guess. That's its connotation for me. And for you too, I think, because for instance, in one of the essays in the book, when you tell a friend that when your great aunt dies, you will fabricate her obituary. And then your friend corrects you and she says, no, you will be correcting a fabrication.
Right. Right. My great aunt wrote a zoology textbook it must have been in the 40s. And it was sort of co-opted at that time. She was a zoology professor, and it was at the time when if you were a woman professor, your department chair could put his name on anything that you wrote or published. And so over the years, her name became the second name, and then eventually it was dropped. And that was one of the things that bothered her throughout her life. So one of the things I said that I wanted to do when she died was to fabricate the obituary, to put her name back on that book. And my friend in this essay mentions, no, you're just correcting a fabrication that life made. So,
yeah. When and how did you become so fascinated with fabrication? Was there an event? Was there a conversation that sparked this project?
Truly, I mean, it was in part the word. And then there were several events. One was I was in a Walmart and was returning a very disposable printer. My old printer had broken down, and you know they can't be fixed. It costs a lot more to fix than to get a new one. And I'd gotten a new one and it didn't work, and I returned it, and they just sort of threw it in a cart alongside a pizza that somebody had returned. And so I was just suddenly kind of overwhelmed with all the stuff in there. And it never occurred to me how it got there or where it went after I was done with it or kind of how it was made. So I became interested in sort of that aspect of fabrication. I've also really always been fascinated by industrial architecture and its connection to modernism. And so I had worked in factories, but it seemed to me that not a lot of people, unless you're a salesperson, goes from one factory to another. So it would be really interesting to sort of go in a lot of industrial spaces and to just kind of get a sense of them. And mm-hmm. and a lot of byproducts of this, that I got to see a lot about the economy at work, kind of at the end of the American Midwest industrial era. And so that was interesting too.
Yeah. The people you met in factories across the state of Indiana, did they talk about their work and the things they were making in similar ways?
That's interesting. I was struck by how often the processes are similar. I mean, I was struck by the kind of pride that people took in the work and the things they make, and how I would be in the casket factory, and I would I was constantly struck by, I mean, when you're just going into a casket factory from off the street and you're a writer, you're immediately struck by this kind of metaphor hitting you in the face of all these empty caskets. And I would often say, you know, do you stop and think about death when you're making these caskets? Do you stop and think about this? And over and over it was, it's, you know, every once in a while you'll stop and look around and see that there are, you know, thousands of caskets or thousands of globes spinning, you know, through mm-hmm. the room. But in general, you concentrate, sort of like, I guess, writing an essay. You're not thinking necessarily about the whole as much as you are kind of image by image or, you know, object by object, and paying attention to that and trying to make it well.
Yeah. Does the metaphor of your job, throwing the rope of words out and trying to catch it, then to walk across it, does it hold for the rest of us, do you think? Are we all kind of engaged in something similar to that?
Well, I guess, that was what was sort of fascinating to me, to think about the fact that viruses make little machines. You know, that's just kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a way in which, I can't remember which scientist it is, but who writes a lot about termites all sort of working on one big thing and not being conscious of what it is they're working on. You do really get that sense that people are all sort of, you know, kind of busy people putting things together and not really getting often a sense of kind of standing back and seeing the whole of what it is, but that we all do that. You kind of make the next thing on faith, you know. So I guess that's true. I think it's you know, just as all jobs are different, it's an artist's or a writer's particular job, maybe, you know, depends even more on kind of going out and trusting that you're going to make it across a chasm and tie, you know, two things together that don't seem to be connected. So
And have the time to step back and look at what you did.
Right, yeah, which is wonderful. I mean, to have that time to be able to step back and look at it, and, you know, be able to say, oh yes, this is what this means. This thing that I'm seeing. When you're not so busy trying to produce, you know, 100 of them in a certain period of time, you do have that time to step back and look at it.
Yeah, in a woodshop. You met a carver, and all around him are saints and Christs. What was it like for you to be in that workspace, and what does he think about as he does his job?
Oh, that was very eerie to me. It's very eerie. These are a family of carvers, and there are Christ just reclining on tables in various stages of being produced, and it's a wonderful shop, and they do these statues for churches all over the country and all over the world. But he would have like a chisel and hammer and be sitting there kind of, you know, chiseling Christ's abdominal muscle, or, you know, it was just very, very eerie. And they were some of the workers that I said, do you ever stop and realize what you're doing, that you're fashioning Christ's ear? Or and the worker said, you know, every once in a while I do. Every once in a while it just suddenly occurs to me and I see what's right there in front of me, but most of the time I don't think about it. I just think about trying to get, you know, that bit of wood smooth, or I'm looking at the prototype, you know, the original one that they work from. It's sort of like making icons, like iconography. They have to work very clearly from the original prototype. And but anyway, he said that every once in a while it did occur to him, and he said it felt like he loved the job, but mostly he loved the work of it. And he was, you know, interested in the fact that there were fashions, that some mm-hmm. years the Christ with the kind of raised hands, the one that he was getting the most orders for, and, you know, so he was conscious of changing fashion, wood tones and things like that.
Yeah. It's, you know, when you stop to think about that, you know, Christ not immune to fashion, and, you know, you think of, you know, what kind of, you know, what's the top-selling Christ figure. That's a little bizarre to think about.
It's very strange, but it is a more optimistic one with risen hands, the sort of risen. But I was struck by that in all of the factories I went to. I mean, you just don't think about changing fashion when it comes to caskets.
Right.
but casket makers are very aware of changing fashion, and so it was interesting to walk through. They have like a room where you can kind of walk through how they market caskets and how they have over the decades. And it was just really fascinating to me to see that the marketing for caskets in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, they felt like something having to do with death, and that it had to do with the fact that the carpet looked old or that the lighting looked was outdated. And once they have the casket in a setting, this was to show people how to market them, in a setting that had more contemporary lighting and more contemporary colors in terms of carpet, and that all of a sudden you don't think about the fact that it's a casket. You know, it doesn't seem so that outdated has something to do, I think, in every product with reminding you of your own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it looks like your grandmother's living room, and your grandmother got old, so you don't want your living room to be that color. So that was really, really interesting to me. I mean, there's fashions in everything. They're in globes. There are the color of the ocean changes slightly, the blue. Depending on, you know, what colors are look more up to date. So it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. And while you were in the Globe Factory, you found yourself wondering about, you know, why is the world still, you know, why are we making globes and maps like this when all this stuff is available out there on the internet or on computer programs? You know, what is it about a globe or a map, you know, that you can hold in your hands or have tacked to the wall that is so attractive?
They're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful objects. And I mean, I asked my daughter that because she's in grade school, and that particular essay, or she is in middle school now, but began with her asking me, why are the colors of countries certain colors, and how do they do this, and how do they do that with globes? And so at the end, I asked her, well, okay, now I've figured out the answers to those questions, but why do you still need them? I mean, don't your teachers, can't they pull up the maps and things on the computer screen? And she said, oh, I know the answer to that. That's really easy. It's because they're so pretty. And, you know, and also because our teacher can say, okay, I'm talking about Ecuador, and may... and it will take quite a while to like call it up on the computer screen and to get it where you want it. Whereas the globe, you can immediately put your hand on it, spin it around, and pass it around the room from hand to hand. So, so she thought that was an obvious question, obvious answer.
Mm. Susan Neville is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her new book, Fabrication, Essays on Making Things and Making Meaning. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan, of all the places you visited, what was your favorite?
I think the glass factory. I mean, a lot of them were really interesting, and there was something sort of strange and odd and interesting, but the glass factory was just magical. I mean, I would go there again, or recommend that people go, because it's an art glass factory that occupies the same space and makes glass the same way they did, and make glass for Tiffany. And it was just magical to see. There are guys whose job is to take these long ladles and to dip the ladles into these big kilns of hot, you know, molten glass. And then they have to run over to an annealing machine. So if you can imagine these guys picking up big spoons full of balls of hot just lava and running across the room, and it's called glass popping. They pitch the glass up in the air about a foot so that it has something to do with a color, but it cools at a particularly perfect temperature, and then they run across and put it on a machine and it flattens out. But it was just amazing to see these guys. It was an incredible art to pop these hot bits of sun really running across a room. And so that was really interesting. And I love glass. I loved seeing how the colors emerged from, you know, the kind of sun. And it was very interesting. The doll factory was interesting. There were a lot of them were just, I could not have made the things up. You know, I was always surprised.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon. Is our caller there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I have a quick question. Probably doesn't relate very well. What do you tell your daughter about why are these countries different colors on the map? I'll just hang up and listen on the radio.
That's a good question.
Okay. It's why are the countries different color on the map? Maps are copyrighted. So a country doesn't become like, you know, Peru is not always pink or something because when Rand McNally does it, it has to be different from when Cram does it, or, you know, from when a map maker is in some ways an artist. And it has to be done differently from the way that map has been done before, unless it's, you know, in the public domain and is a copy and mentions that. So it's actually the cartographer. And again, in some way, sometimes working with marketing people who makes these decisions, and it's like, you know, making decisions how to decorate your house or what colors to use. So it varies with the company and with the cartographer who makes these decisions.
Yeah, and a cartographer, according to something I learned here in this book, is that they're allowed a bit of fabrication in terms of inventing a place, so to protect their work.
They do, because there are, I think it's Rand McNally that would put a McNally Junction or something like that on every map, because then you know if somebody does just, you know, take it to, now it would be a Kinko's or something, and make a copy and then make your own prints and try to sell them. It's that little bit of fabrication that foils the plagiarist. So that little kind of false place sometimes is on the map. But, you know, there are a lot of things you choose, type, font, colors, all those things. There's a little bit of creativity having to do with maps.
Yeah. I wonder how many people have tried to go to McNally Junction.
Though. I don't know. That's a very good question.
You mentioned the glass factory as a place that you really love to visit. Where is it, and what is its name?
It's Kokomo Opalescent Glass Company, and it's in Kokomo, Indiana. Mm. And so it's a great space. See, they have an actually really interesting website, too. You can see all the colors, and they make the glass using the same recipes that they used, for 100 years. You can see they have the books there with the old recipes from, I think the man's name is Bob Green or Bill Green or something, and his dad had the same name, and his grandfather had the same name, so they've all been sort of looking through these books for these recipes for quite a while.
Yeah. There were places that you really enjoyed visiting, and then there were some places that you can sense, you know, and you tell us, you tell readers that, you know, this makes you uncomfortable, or I could not work here.
Right.
And one of the places I thought was really interesting, you felt uncomfortable, you had a panic attack, was at the Farm Progress Show.
Oh, that's funny. I thought you were going to mention the steel mill. Yeah, that's true. There, like, I don't think of myself as a panicky person, but I think I did have an attack in the steel mill and at the Farm Progress Show. And the Farm Progress Show, I was just going toward it through fields of genetically engineered, for the most part, corn, because all the fields around the corn, the Farm Progress Show, had become like a giant commercial. So there, you know, in order to get there, you had to go through these fields of just really high corn with, you know, Pioneer engineered by DeKalb or whatever. And I had that sort of, I think Willa Cather describes it in a lot of her books, of, you know, that kind of tall grass prairie sort of dizziness. And I felt that in these fields of just kind of never-ending corn. It was like a Stephen King experience or something.
Yeah, between the advertising and the corn. Just...
Right, yeah. Well, the corn itself was the advertising. It was like a three-dimensional billboard, but it was fields that, you know, they had planted the corn, the best corn, they had worked with it all season in order to have it at exactly the right point for when people would be coming from, you know, different agricultural states around the Midwest to attend the show. So the fields themselves were the advertising.
Mm. What was it about the steel plant that pushed your panic button?
Oh, well, the steel plant, I think it didn't just push my panic button, it pushed. I was at the steel mill with actually a group of MBA students from Japan, and they had come over in a Fighting Illini bus. They were from University of Illinois, and we all got a little panicked. It's a very, very large, kind of terrifying Tim Burton movie kind of setting. Just an enormous, very cold, very industrial space. And the steel itself, when it's melted, is hotter than the surface of the sun. And there are often what's called things called breakouts. The surface of steel is sort of held together with a skin like a balloon, or like the, you know, top of water in a glass. And if it's punctured, then it can kind of come out of the flow out of the machine. So there are lots of alarms going off in a steel mill, and we were led around by the director of safety, which I thought was sort of funny. So we were to feel very safe, but at one point there were alarms going off, and we were kind of led into a room while we waited for whatever was going on to be over with. So. Mm.
So not a place you'd like to go back to?
Not a place I'd like to go back to, no.
The doll factory kind of surprised me a little bit, because that you liked it and you found it comforting, and that yet here are all these little doll parts, you know,
yeah,
this inventory of pieces of dolls that, you know, resemble children, babies.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange.
There is something sort of ghoulish about it. I mean, one of the things that was most interesting is that these were dolls with vinyl heads, and they kind of take liquid vinyl and put it into molds, and then the heads spin around, and it looks like I don't know, what is that? Oh shoot, I can't think of the movie, but where the heads spin around, and then in order to get the vinyl doll's heads out of the molds, they have to puncture the back of the heads. So there's a guy who takes an ice pick and sort of, you know, punks it into the back of the doll's heads, and then pulls the head with oiled gloves out of the mold. So it looked very much like giving birth. And then he has to blow the head up. So there's also this other sort of strange side of the head filling with air so they can put the eyes in. But I think it was soothing. I mean, despite the sort of ghoulishness of the parts of the dolls, because it was small, it was sort of manageable. And there was a kind of sweetness because it wasn't taking the dolls apart, it was putting them together. So, you know, the parts were made, but then there were for the most part, women who attached the parts together and made something that was beautiful by the end, you know. And so they were kind of very delicately painting on eyelashes and, you know, were painting the cheek color on the cheeks. And so I think it wasn't a kind of destructive thing. It was a taking parts and putting them back together. So it was pleasant. It was sweet to see the hair go on, and it was interesting.
Also, if I'm recalling correctly, the place where these dolls are made is almost like a dollhouse factory.
It is. It's the factory itself. It's like a Mary Kay cosmetic pink Cadillac. It was kind of the factory version of that. On the outside, it looks like a dollhouse. It's a kind of yellow cottage style looking place. And it's not until you get inside that you realize it's actually a factory, and that they're producing a lot of dolls. So anyway, that was sort of interesting. Like I didn't go to this, but the Longaberger Basket Factory in Ohio, the corporate headquarters, it looks like a giant Longaberger basket. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
In a shopping mall food court in a big city, I don't know if this was Indianapolis or Chicago, but you're sitting enjoying, everyone is in, well, I don't know if enjoying is the right word, but you're eating all kinds of different food in this place, and all gathered together, and everyone more or less is in their own little world. And you find yourself wondering, you know, about the people around you. Do they ever ask where this apple came from, this rice, this bowl of soup? Let me just continue here to read this paragraph. Perhaps. You don't own a seed, a sprig of grass. You couldn't make anything if your life depended on it. You live 10 stories high in an apartment in Chicago. Everything you need, you have to buy, and the thing you buy it with is more and more surreal. There's a holographic bird on the corner of your credit card. In the right light, it hovers an inch or two above the plastic. You've somehow tied your fate to it.
Yeah, I one of the things that doing these essays made me, I guess, really, really conscious of how surreal in some ways our economy is, and how much we consume, and how much just stuff there is, you know, around us, and how unaware I am, and I'm assuming other people are too, of where it comes from, how it got there, what we did to deserve it, you know. And I just was very, very struck by that over and over again. I mean, when I get a globe, I think about the, you know, woman who spends 8 hours a day affixing the equator tape on the globe now, you know, just standing there putting this little 16th of an inch wide piece of tape, you know, to hold the world together. But in malls particularly, it just really struck by all that stuff and how we just don't think about it, you know. So
yeah. Well, the credit card business is very surreal. It seems every other day you can get an offer in the mail for a new credit card, and they've gone from gold to platinum.
Right, yeah.
And now, not too long ago, we received an offer for a titanium card.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. And you get smart cards or something that have all sorts of information on them, and it's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just kept having these when I was in at a veneer plant, for instance, I was just over and over struck by the global, you know, the global economy and how much of this stuff is we consume and don't make. And then pay for with some sort of surreal little plastic thing. And it just in some ways felt eerie,
yeah.
And very, very surreal. So,
The veneer capital of the world, Edinburgh, Indiana.
The veneer capital of the world.
You go there and here they're making veneer, which then goes to China. And
right.
Then comes back to the U.S. and winds up in your mall at the Bombay.
At Bombay
Company.
Furniture, yeah. The reason Edinburgh is the veneer capital of the world is because Illinois, Indiana, and used to be covered by a hardwood forest, and veneer. I mean, I thought veneer is a word like fabrication. I thought veneer was really interesting. And I always think of veneer as something very cheap, you know, hiding something that's you know, very kind of very cheap. So it was interesting to see what veneer actually is, and that there's a, you know, kind of an art to veneer, and to see it being made. It was really kind of fascinating. But when I was in the veneer factory, I ended up. Talking to a woman from China who was a representative for the veneer capital, and she comes there and looks through the veneer. Veneer is kind of an artistic thing too. There's a pattern, and you use the pattern to make different designs on furniture, low end furniture and high end furniture. And she was saying, I come here, I get the veneer, take it back to China, where it's then made into furniture, which then ends up back here at the mall, you know, right near the factory. So I was at the point I was writing this essay, I was surprised by that. I'm not surprised by it now. In the casket factory, they used quilts that are made in China for casket linings, and the quilts are fully made quilts, and then they come here and they're made so cheaply, or they're so inexpensive for the factory to buy, that they then can kind of rip the quilt into pieces and then re-sew it together to make linings.
Very strange. After writing these essays, or while you were at work writing them, doing the research, did you have an urge to make stuff?
Well, essays. Yeah.
But I mean,
yeah.
You know, cookies or or a skirt or,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, that was one of the things, I think.
Or start whittling or...
I used to do things like that all the time. I mean, I think that's maybe a part of what started it now that I think about it. My grandmother and my mother died just a few years ago, and when I was a kid, we always sat around and we all had sewing machines, and we sewed, and, you know, we did all these sort of girl things, baked, and now my life is, like most of our lives, so busy, and a lot of that busyness is just running around shopping and then taking care of the things you bought. I mean, you know, it's sort of crazy. So I did have this kind of nostalgia for, you know, being able to slow down a little bit and make something, especially when, you know, you go to a cookie factory or something and you realize, a lot of the stuff I'm eating is made in a factory and made so that it won't break, rather than, you know, so that it tastes good or you know, is nutritionally sound or something. And so, yeah, I did have an urge to make things, though I have not followed through with it.
Mm. Tell us where you wrote the book and what it was like to work in that space.
I wrote the book in what used to be a Stutz Bearcat factory, and there's still the Stutz Bearcat was made in Indianapolis, and you know, there were a lot of automobile manufacturers in this area, Duesenberg and Studebaker, and that no longer exist. And so this space still has that feel of that industrial space. Part of the building has not been renovated at all, and there are just sort of cheap little offices, and artists rent them, and massage people rent them, and they're kind of very inexpensive offices. And I thought it would be a good space to work on this book because I would be working in a place that still had that feel of being a factory, and still has, you know, some parts of the building, it's an enormous building, still have kind of small manufacturing areas in them too. So it was great. I mean, I could kind of go out of my little, I had the dingiest office that looked out onto a roof with tar on it, and it was very dusty, and but it was perfect in terms of, you know, being a place to work on this particular book.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, Susan.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Susan Neville has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is Fabrication, Essays on Making Things and Making Meaning. The book is published by McMurray and Beck. Susan Neville's other books include The Invention of Flight and In the House of Blue Lights. Our thanks, too, to the folks at WFYI in Indianapolis, where we spoke with Susan this afternoon. She joined us this afternoon from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis.